If you tweet about this event, and we're encouraging you to tweet about it, use hashtag VABook2016. I want to thank the City of Charlottesville for sponsoring the Virginia Festival of the Book and for providing this great venue. This is one of my favorite venues. The event is being recorded for broadcast on Charlottesville's own TV10 and will be available online at www.charlottesville.org/TV10. If you have a question during the Q&A portion of the discussion at the end, about 15 minutes or so, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone to be brought around. We've got a roaming microphone. Festival of the Book is free of charge, but as you can imagine, it's not free of cost. Please remember to go online to give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni. That's where the headquarters is. And support this festival so we may sustain it for many, many more years. Here's another thing that's really important. Did everybody get your yellow evaluations? Please fill out program evaluations and give us great marks for this event. These provide useful information that helps keep the festival free and open to the public. You can fill out a paper evaluation before you leave or complete it online at vabook.org/survey. And the reason I make a point about this is we don't get enough, my point of view, we don't get enough good military history programs in the Virginia Festival of the Book, so please fill out a great one for us. Please support festival authors and our local booksellers by purchasing a book today. Authors will be available for book signing immediately after the program. Now, we're going to start right off. This first gentleman is the author of War in the Chesapeake, The British Campaigns to Control the Bay, 1813-1814. He's director of the U.S. Marine Corps History Division and Gray Research Center at Marine Corps Base Quantico, Virginia. Please join me in welcoming Charlie Niemeyer.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it. Well, to keep us on time and to keep us on track, I'll get right to it. There are few places in America that were more affected by warfare than the Chesapeake Bay during the War of 1812. It was one of the last places where a foreign invader, not counting the Civil War, obviously, had actually laid a pretty heavy hand on Americans and American wherewithal, as well as the buildings and infrastructure. And that happened in the Chesapeake, and you have to ask yourself, well, why does it happen during the War of 1812? And the second thing is, why does the government let it happen? Because essentially what the Madison administration does throughout most of this time is kind of default to the governors of Maryland and Virginia for their own defense. The main effort for the Americans was on the Canadian frontier. The issue that got us into the war in the first place, and I love these cartoons from this time because it's always pretty good stuff, is free trade and sailors' rights. In fact, if you would see that moniker on broadsides, on pamphlets, on publications, it wasn't anything about anything else. It was about the fact that the United States was feeling the pressure of the Napoleonic Wars between France and Britain, in that the British began to clamp down on the ability for the Americans to be neutral traders in this increasingly growing and globalizing war. This is a picture of a poor landsman being dragooned into service aboard a Royal Navy man of war and during the Napoleonic era. You see his wife kneeling, begging for his release, and of course, other guys that are willingly taking the King's shilling going off to be in the Royal Navy. To be in the Royal Navy was bad, though. It was almost a virtual death sentence for most people. Most sailors who were on a Royal Navy man of war never saw their 30th birthday. And he didn't die necessarily from combat action. The vast majority of the sailors died from disease or, more often, shipboard accidents, where they would fall from the fighting tops, or they'd fall from the rigging, or they'd get hit by a block and tackle in the head and or something of that nature. And literally, they would pass away and be buried at sea and be never heard from again. So free trade and sailors' rights are the theme that the United States uses to go to war against Great Britain in the War of 1812. What is the British view, though, of the United States and Madison? And this is a great cartoon, and the reason why I love it is that you'll see the devil off to the right there, and here he is, you know, dancing around. And Madison is complaining to Napoleon, who has his arm on his shoulder. He says, "'Tis you two that have got me into this mess that I've been in." And Napoleon saying, "Well, not to worry. The devil will help us both." But my favorite part is the angel Gabriel here blowing a horn Obviously representing the interests of the British here. And coming out of the horn, and you can't quite see it on the slide, is the words, bad news for you. So no kidding. The United States took on a superpower, and they were saying, now that you have us aroused, stand by for heavy rolls. And so there were problems right off from the beginning, because the United States of America in 1812 was very similar politically to what we kind of have today, which is a very split country. They had the Federalists at the time opposing Madison's Republicans. And the problem was, when Madison went to war, it was seen as Mr. Madison's war or a Republican war. And this is a cartoon that was done of a riot that had taken place of a number of gentlemen from Montgomery County, Maryland. And it says, problems in Baltimore or the Montgomery County War Dance. And they're holding little hatchets in their hands, as you can see, dancing around in a circle like a Native American tribe getting ready to go on a raid, while others plot the downfall of the government at the Bull's Head Tavern in Baltimore. And so this riot that occurs in Baltimore right after the war begins is going to set the kind of the stage for and the tone for the war in the Chesapeake. Now, fortunately for the Americans, we had some early naval success, USS Constitution versus Guerriere, and they had USS Constitution versus Java and a few others. There was a three-frigate victory that occurs during the War of 1812 that were pretty significant. In memory, the British Royal Navy could not remember losing a ship-to-ship engagement to another nation. So that's what made it very, very significant. The problem is that once they did lose those frigates, the British decided to come to the Chesapeake in full force to really drive the U.S. Navy and any sort of other sailing vessels off the seas as soon as they could. What is their strategy in 1813? Well, they're going to break into the bay with an amphibious task force. And this is pretty significant because we don't have a navy per se. We have a single frigate that's guarding the Chesapeake Bay at the time, the USS Constellation. And it, unfortunately, is blockaded right in Norfolk at the beginning of the campaign. So what the British decide to do is to conduct raids up the length and breadth of the bay in a brilliant maneuver of using the sea as a high-speed avenue of approach. And that's exactly what they do. The second benefit they get out of it is they get to kill off the American privateer fleet, causing the Americans, and this is their words, to feel the hard hand of war. What they wanted to do was change the venue of fighting from the Canadian frontier to the American Middle States, and thereby conducting a punitive campaign, meaning if they were able to get their hands on any sort of American military stores, or even if they don't, they could raid towns and villages and burn them to the ground, which they do. They were going to sack possibly the larger towns of Norfolk, Virginia, Annapolis, Maryland, and even the large city of Baltimore. And again, if they could, capture or sink the USS Constellation, then blockaded in Norfolk. There's the other sidebar benefit. This is a modern-day shot of the Pride of Baltimore, which was the USS Chasseur. It was a privateer. And the other vessel there is the Lynx, and it was going to be captured in a raid the British are going to conduct up the Rappahannock River in April of 1813. And these two ship replicas still exist today. They're going to be actually reenacting the Battle of St. Leonard's Creek here in a few weeks. This is the guy leading the attack. His name is Sir John Borlase Warren, and he's 59 years old. He has some political experience. He was the former minister to Russia for Great Britain. He now comes to the United States and is told to end this war quickly as he can. He's given the entire charge of the North American station, and he aims to do that. He was going to break into the Chesapeake in order to make the Madison administration realize they cannot continue the war and risk the loss of these large cities that are very valuable to the cause. Here's his second in command, and this is what really made the things tough for the Americans. This is Rear Admiral Sir George Cockburn. He pronounced it Cockburn, as I found out from my British colleagues when I presented the same lecture at the University of London. And so Cockburn is portrayed here, and you can see buildings on fire in the background. That's supposed to represent the Washington, D.C. City itself being burned to the ground by Cockburn. As we're going to see, he really doesn't burn much of the city at all, but he's credited with it, and he actually gets himself painted in a portrait with the same view. Upper Bay raids are pretty nasty, and they're pretty tough, but they demonstrate what I call the modus operandi for the conduct of the campaign. What they're going to do is they're going to attack any towns that have the temerity to stand up to British landing parties. So what they're going to do is if the militia shows up and fires back, then they have the right to burn towns to the ground, and that's exactly what they're going to do to the town of Havre de Grace, Maryland, as well as Georgetown and Fredericktown. All three towns are sacked and heavily damaged. The activity on the lower bay meets with with less success, but nonetheless, they are moving up and down the bay. Now, there's another benefit to this high-speed avenue of approach. It freezes the militia in place. So every time the British make a landing, Royal Marines and Blue Jackets actually outnumber the local militia. So, you know, during the War of 1812, the common phrase was the militia was just terrible. There was an apocryphal statement made by one British commander when he's asked, who is he facing in this next town they're coming to? He said, well, it was mostly militia. And he said, I don't care if it rains militia. And so, in fact, he, you know, whether or not he said that or not is beside the point. Their attitude towards militia was pretty low, but you have to give the militia some credit. They were always outnumbered in almost every one of these engagements. The British Royal Marines and Blue Jackets would get there, and you never knew where they were going to end up next. One night they'd be in Havre de Grace, the next night they'd be off Kent Island, the next night after that they'd be in front of Annapolis. So these are the sorts of problems that the militia had, but Cockburn understood how amphibious warfare was supposed to work, and he uses it to great effect. And here's Havre de Grace getting burned to the ground. This is a propaganda picture done by the Americans. They're raiding, you know, baby cribs and throwing out blankets and just, you know, burning things willy-nilly. And actually, Havre de Grace is going to lose about 50 or 60 buildings. About 60% of the town is going to be burned to the ground and end up in ashes. Norfolk, however, is the big prize in the 1813 campaign. And they send the 102nd Regiment of Foot, which is formerly the New South Wales Corps. For those of you who know anything about the word New South Wales, that should ring a bell, because that's really Australia. And if Australia was the penal colony for Great Britain, the 102nd Regiment of Foot was the same thing for its army. All the ne'er-do-wells, all the guys that had been court-martialed, all the guys that had gotten in trouble were put in the 102nd Regiment of Foot. So when they show up at Norfolk in 1813, they are going to be really tough to handle. And these guys do a pretty good number on the city of Hampton, Virginia, burning it to the ground and committing a number of atrocities. Nevertheless, the Americans are going to win a close-run engagement at the Battle of Craney Island. They're going to preserve Norfolk for the American cause, and they're also going to preserve the Constellation. Constellation sailors and Marines are going to play a key role in the defense of Craney Island, and thanks to them, their artillery was used to great effect, and the British are defeated at Norfolk during this particular engagement. And here's the map itself. There's only one last hope, though, once the British do, continue their raids up and down the length and breadth of the Chesapeake. And this guy, Joshua Barney, is the last best hope of the Chesapeake Bay. He's a former Revolutionary War commander, absolutely fearless, tough fighter. He's under a cloud when he comes back to America because he served for a brief time in the French Navy. And unfortunately, while the French were fighting the Quasi-War against the United States in 1799, 1800. But nonetheless, he gets out of the French Navy because he did what John Paul Jones did, sold his services to the next highest bidder. But he comes back and he says, well, the way to take the British on in the Chesapeake Bay is not to build ships to try to compete with them, because there's no way we can do it. They just have too many and they're too expensive to build. So what Joshua Barney decides to do was build a flotilla of row galleys, and they can move in these inlets and waterways and tributaries, and they're not dependent upon wind power. So they can kind of do a swarm attack on these British vessels that are located in these shallow waters. And he will hire flotilla men. This is an African-American citizen of Maryland. His name is Charles Ball. He serves in Barney's flotilla. They're neither Army nor Navy, and they made sure everybody else knew that. They were their own separate service during the War of 1812. And the flotilla was seen as the way to stop this British raiding capacity. And at first, the British take notice. They're gonna focus on Barney and the flotilla for the next 6 to 12 months of the two-year campaign. They did some other experiments in how to defend the bay. They call this the Yankee torpedo. This is a British cartoon. The stuff coming out of that big fish's mouth are a bunch of junk, a skeleton, scissors, a ball and chain, anything they could stick in there. But it was a floating mine. And the idea was a guy named Elijah Mix was going to float one up against a British man of war that was stationary at the time and set it off. And he almost pulls it off. He spots the HMS Plantagenet, a 74-gun vessel off of Cape Henry Light. He sneaks up on it in the middle of the night. He lets the torpedo go. Unfortunately, it detonates about maybe 10 feet too soon, and all it does is send a huge column of cascading water over the deck, and the torpedo is a failure. So the British aren't really impressed with the torpedoes, but there is a future with the sea mines, as we're going to find out in the 20th and even today in the 21st century. Warren is relieved for the 1814 campaign, and he's replaced by this guy, Vice Admiral Alexander Cochrane. And this is the guy that's going to be even tougher than Warren. He's going to keep Coburn as his second in command, which is a good move on his part, because Coburn can tell him where the weaknesses are in America. And they actually utilize Coburn's advice to great effect. But the idea is that we have the British are saying they have to basically embarrass the Madison administration. So the idea might be once they kill Barney's flotilla, they will then move on Washington, D.C., and attack Washington, perhaps then attack Baltimore from the rear. And that's exactly what his strategy is. He wants to liberate slaves. He's going to create a corps of liberated slaves called Colonial Marines. They're going to be based on Tangier Island. And their objective oftentimes was talked about as Rhode Island, Charleston, or even New Orleans. But Coburn convinces Cochrane to stick around and say, let's give the Chesapeake one more summer. And he wanted a crack at Washington, but they really wanted Baltimore, that nest of Republicans and Madisonites. So these are the Colonial Marines, Southern Maryland raids. And they decide to go after Barney's flotilla near the Patuxent River, and they fight a small skirmish with his forces at a place called St. Leonard's Creek. And Barney and his flotilla are eventually able to get away by driving off the British blockading forces in a night engagement just at the head of St. Leonard's Creek. But it only gives him a temporary reprieve, because all this does is allow Barney to escape this smaller creek and then get up the larger Patuxent River, but he still can't get out of the Patuxent River, and that was a real problem for Barney. So as a result, this three-pronged attack is going to work out really well for Cochrane. He's going to keep Barney bottled up, and the idea is he's going to kill Barney's fleet. He's going to then attack the upper bay with a squadron of British ships under a guy named Sir Peter Parker, no relation to Spider-Man. And then they're going to land at Benedict, Maryland. They're going to kill Barney, as I said, and then basically go up the Potomac River as a diversion and attack Alexandria, Virginia. Bladensburg is after they wreck Barney's flotilla at Upper Marlboro, Maryland. They decide to move on Bladensburg, Maryland. I don't have a lot of time to go into detail, but needless to say, Bladensburg is an absolute debacle. They call it the Bladensburg Races in Great Britain. Robert Ross, the commanding general of the British forces there, with four regiments of British troops, these are first-rate veterans from Wellington's army, are going to run into mainly a Maryland militia, some Virginia militia, and some regular forces under Barney and the U.S. Army. But the Barney and U.S. Army regular forces are utilized in a third line about a mile and a half back from the crossing point where the British break through the American lines. But it is an absolute debacle for the Americans. It's a poorly planned operation from start to finish. And once the British dispose of the Americans at Bladensburg, the way to Washington, D.C. is open, and they march right into Washington that day and proceed to destroy the public buildings of the town. They don't burn the town, and a lot of people think they burned the town to the ground. It wasn't much of a town to start with in 1812, but they do burn the public buildings that were available. So I always say what really happened in Washington, D.C. is they burned the Capitol. They burned the Navy. Well, actually, they don't burn the Navy Yard. The Americans burned the Navy Yard. There was a frigate almost ready to be launched there, the USS Columbia. It gets burned to its hull. They burned the White House. They burned a few homes, but the homes where sharpshooters were shooting at the British as they went down Pennsylvania Avenue. An American militiaman tried to assassinate Ross, the commanding general of the British forces, in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue by shooting from the window of the home of Albert Gallatin, the Secretary of the Treasury. So his home went up to the torch as well. But within 25 hours, the British are already out of town. The amazing part about this 25-hour period is they have remarkable little damages done to the private sector at all. So the third body that went up the river is under this guy, James Gordon. He's the guy that we think they patterned the character in Patrick O'Brien's sailing series, Master and Commander. They think he is the real Master and Commander, James Gordon. And he later literally takes Alexandria without really firing a shot, and he gets away scot-free. The British now move, as they said, on Baltimore. They're going to basically land on the eastern side of the city and move up their naval forces to a place within about 2 miles of their main fortification, Fort McHenry, which guards the entrance to the inner harbor. But the idea is that they're going to force the entrance, enfilade the forces on top of Hampstead Hill, which is just behind where North Point is. But they're going to fight a pretty large reconnaissance in force that was being commanded by a guy named Brigadier General John Stricker. The British are going to drive the Americans off with heavy casualties to their own forces. They believe that this might possibly be the American main effort. When they break through and they look up on that hill and they see about 15,000 Americans with cannon and dug-in positions and rifle pits, the British commander on the ground, who is now a colonel since Robert Ross was shot by a sharpshooter in this particular battle of North Point. Arthur Brooke, the colonel, says there's no way we're going to be able to take this town unless the Navy breaks in to the fort. So they bombard Fort McHenry for 24 hours, this guy is killed at North Point. He was from Rostrefer, Northern Ireland. I visited his home last summer, a beautiful place, and he was a well-known commanding officer under Wellington and was a pretty professional soldier when he got killed. He got shot through the chest with a musket ball and died. Commodore John Rodgers, United States Navy, is going to guard what's known as Rodgers Bastion, modern-day Patterson Park in Baltimore, Maryland, and they're going to be tied in with the Hampstead Hill guys. And this is the guy defending the fort. His name is Major George Armistead. He's related to the famous Armistead family of Maryland, Lewis Armistead. I believe his nephew or his great-nephew.
Nephew is
going to be leading the attack, one of the brigadiers in Pickett's charge at Gettysburg later on in the Civil War. But he's going to do a great job of defending the fort. Unfortunately for him, the fort is out of range. The fort's guns cannot range the British fleet. They have bomb ships that could actually throw a 200-pound carcass, as they called those shells in those days, into the fort without getting hit back in return. So for 24 hours, he has to take it. He remarkably only loses four casualties killed when a round hits a gun that four soldiers are standing by and they lose their lives. Brigadier General Samuel Smith is going to be the overall commanding general in charge of everything, and he's going to do a fantastic job. He's good because during the American Revolution, he guarded another fort, Fort Mifflin in Philadelphia, as a 24-year-old lieutenant colonel.
Wow.
So he knows his business and does quite well at Fort McHenry. And here's the fort itself. A lot of people don't understand that the fort itself does not have a bomb-proof magazine. Only Armistead knew that the magazine was not bomb-proof. So in order to mitigate any possibility of a secondary explosion by a rocket or missile crashing in, he rolls out all the powder behind the fort and spreads it out. So if a barrel goes up, it only destroys that. And of course, at the end of the campaign, the Americans withstand the bombardment. At the end of the bombardment, the next morning at 7 a.m., the flag is still there. Francis Scott Key writes it down and composes the Star-Spangled Banner on the spot. He's sitting in the harbor negotiating the release of some American prisoners that had been taken during the Washington campaign. And as a result, we have this wonderful national anthem we have today. It's a remarkable song in that he did it with really little changes to the words and puts it to a tune that hardly anyone can sing. So that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie. Our next panelist is author of a Confederate biography, The Cruise of the CSS Shenandoah. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy, served 20 years as a Navy surface warfare officer on many oceans. Thanks for your service. Building on a lifetime of study in naval history, he lives and writes in Noakesville, Virginia, the metropolis of Noakesville. Join me in welcoming Dwight Hughes.
Thank you very much. Raphael Sims, former captain of the infamous CSS Alabama, introduced his memoirs with the following. The cruise of a ship is a biography. The ship becomes a personification. She not only walks the waters like a thing of life, but she speaks in moving accents to those capable of interpreting her. A ship can be, therefore, a central character in a life story through which we view the past more clearly. Following in the wake of her sisters, the CSS Shenandoah was the last of the Confederate raiders. Her mission? To continue destruction of Union commerce so effectively advanced by the Alabama, now resting silently on the bottom of the English Channel after her fiery clash with the USS Kearsarge in June 1864. From October 1864 until November 1865, Shenandoah carried the conflict around the globe to the ends of the earth, through every extreme of sea and storm. She was purchased from British owners, armed and commissioned near the island of Madeira. At almost the same moment, in an ocean away, as autumn blazed the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, General Phil Sheridan routed Jubal Early's rebels at the Battle of Cedar Creek, a bloody ending to the Second Valley Campaign. The very day that lost one Shenandoah to the Confederacy saw the birth of another. Shenandoah was a British extreme clipper with a steam engine, built in Glasgow for the China tea trade. Similar to the famous Cutty Sark, the last of the type, now preserved at Greenwich, she was the epitome of the ancient art of tall ship construction and a prime example of the new technology of the machine age. She could overtake almost any victim and outrun any enemy. Shenandoah's officers represented a cross-section of the Confederacy, from Old Dominion First Families through the Deep South aristocracy to a middle-class Missourian. They included a nephew of Robert E. Lee, a grandnephew of founder George Mason, a son-in-law to Raphael Sims, grandsons of men who fought at George Washington's side, and an uncle of Theodore Roosevelt. These men considered themselves Americans, Southerners, rebels, and warriors embarking on the voyage of their lives. All except the captains and the ship's surgeon were under the age of 25. Okay. They were defending their country as they understood it and pursuing a difficult, dangerous mission in which they succeeded spectacularly after it no longer mattered. But the men they led were a polyglot assemblage of international merchant sailors enlisted in foreign ports or from captured ships with enticements of gold and threats of confinement. These sailors were of nearly every nation and color, mostly English, Irish, Scandinavian, and German, but also South Asian and Pacific Islander, along with a few born and raised Yankees and several African Americans. Most had never set foot on American soil. The officers strove to earn the sailors' loyalty and to balance discipline with humanity, and they succeeded. Most sailors of the Shenandoah served loyally and energetically through a difficult and a dangerous cruise. Shenandoah destroyed 8 Yankee vessels on her way around the Cape of Good Hope and across the stormy Indian Ocean. In Melbourne, she caused a sensation. The people were fascinated by, if not entirely informed about, their faraway cousin's conflict. As word spread of her arrival, hundreds of sightseers streamed along the shore. Boats under steam, sail, and oar descended from every direction to view their first and only Confederate visitor. The ship was besieged by sightseers, traveling as far as 300 miles, evoking a carnival atmosphere. An estimated 10,000 came aboard in one day. The people of Melbourne split into contentious political camps. One welcomed and celebrated their guests. The other demanded her immediate departure. This was the war down under. William Blanchard, U.S. consul in Melbourne, carried on a fierce diplomatic war, a barrage of protests. It must be evident, Blanchard contended, that all presumptions of fact and law were against the legal character of the vessel, which had no legitimacy as a commissioned warship of a recognized nation. Vessel and men should be seized for piracy. But upon the advice of Crown law officers, the governor responded to Consul Blanchard. There was no evidence of piratical acts, and whatever the previous history of Shenandoah, the government was bound to treat her as a ship of war belonging to a belligerent power. The people of Melbourne, like their English counterparts and many foreigners, did not comprehend the complexities of the war. But in an age tinged with romantic notions of honor and valor, they related to her famous predecessor. The CSS Alabama had been a tangible manifestation of the Confederacy. Her exploits brought the contest to them in the language of ocean commerce and ocean conflict, which they understood very well. Having no particular stake in the success of the Union or understanding of its concepts, many looked on the men of Alabama as valiant heroes fighting great odds. Captain Sims was an international celebrity, at least as much as Lincoln, Grant, and Lee. Despite vehement protests from the United States, Confederate cruisers had been welcomed in colonial ports such as Jamaica, Trinidad, and Gibraltar. The Alabama caused a stir in Cape Town in August 1863 with parties and balls in her honor. Later, just the rumors of her appearance off Hobson's Bay created a flurry of excitement in Melbourne. Much of this glamour transferred to Shenandoah, which is precisely what the Confederates intended. A significant number of influential people in Melbourne, however, were acutely worried about the visitors. There appeared to be little discussion or public debate of the central issues: Union, secession, states' rights, slavery. Pro-Union sentiment focused on repugnance for commerce raiding, dangers for the umbilical cords of trade with Europe and America, and local issues such as land reform and tariffs. The Civil War generated economic uncertainty even in Australia, with widely fluctuating prices and availability affecting huge quantities of imports. Despite these concerns, the preponderance of sympathy was for the South, echoing perceptions and misperceptions of many in Great Britain and Europe. Conspicuous in gray uniforms, Shenandoah officers were approached on the streets, showered with social invitations, presented free open tickets by the railway company, voted members of the cricket club and of the prestigious Melbourne club, and attended the theater gratis. Repairs completed, Shenandoah once more attained her natural element, cheered by a crowd of spectators on adjacent wharves. The colonial steamer of war Victoria and a few other vessels dipped their flags in salute, the last international recognition the Confederate banner would receive. The Melbourne Herald proclaimed, "Peace is what the Southerners ask for. Peace meaning recognition and a new empire. The Federals declare there shall be no peace without submission and their dictatorship. The South is engaged in a war of independence. The North has no more chance to conquer them than had Cornwallis. Europe had acknowledged the Confederate states as belligerents, concluded the editors, and ought to have declared the South an empire." It is ironic that sympathy for the Confederacy in Great Britain was concentrated in ruling elites of title and wealth, identifying with aristocratic Southerners and fearing Yankee democracy, the tyranny of the mob. While many subjects of the Queen in colonial Melbourne, more in tune with radical politics and the expanding franchise, favored the South as a champion opposing tyrannical central government. These Melbournians were on the wrong side of the war and the right side of history. 19 February, 1865, Confederate troops evacuated the cradle of the Confederacy, Charleston, South Carolina, to the encircling host of General Sherman. On that same day, the CSS Shenandoah sailed from Melbourne, repaired, resupplied, and with 45 new crewmen. Leaving Melbourne, Shenandoah sailed into the vast Pacific, and on April Fool's Day, 1865, approached the island of Pohnpei, where she captured four American whalers. Burning Yankee vessels illuminated alien surroundings, while Richmond went up in flames. This uniquely American conflagration flared simultaneously at both ends of the earth. The young officers of Shenandoah were fascinated by the island and its people. One of them marveled at the mingling of green and bright aquamarine, which gave a cool, refreshing appearance to the harbor. Their pilot and translator was a Yorkshire Englishman who had been on the island for 13 years after escaping from Sydney as a convict. He claimed to have read of the war in newspapers brought by visiting ships and to have informed the chiefs about it. They were, according to him, great admirers of Jefferson Davis. Captain Waddell recalled in his memoirs, "The clash of Southern arms electrified the minds of men in the remotest parts of the earth. Its heroism and dash were borne upon the wings of the morning and wafted by the breezes into the very habitations of the isolated barbarians." Waddell invited the local chief to visit Shenandoah. They shared a pipe and schnapps in the captain's cabin, which put the chief quite at ease, and then toured the ship. The chief and his party were astonished and amused by the big guns, steam engine, and freshwater condenser, but seemed to comprehend and appreciate their functions without confusion or fear. Meanwhile, a fleet of canoes surrounded them, with sun pouring down upon bare backs, many holding up large green umbrellas, or large green leaves as umbrellas. The chief departed in the best of spirits, inviting all ashore with a hearty welcome. The ship received quantities of coconuts, pineapples, pigs, chickens, bananas, and plantains, giving tobacco in pay. The Southerners considered the whole affair ridiculous, but the chief would have been greatly pleased. He was leader of one of the most powerful clans. The royal reception and tour of Shenandoah, a privilege that whalers and traders did not extend, was a significant enhancement of the chief's prestige. Gifts and the promise of loot from the captured whalers were especially effective as confirmation of his authority. The people were constantly around the ship, bartering fruit, shells, and curiosities, as well as pigs and chickens. Shenandoah officers amused themselves touring, hunting, sailing, swimming, and trading tobacco or cloth for native curios, while, unbeknownst to them, the guns fell silent at Appomattox. One of the lieutenants was particularly entranced by a young girl, so small, so sweet, so innocent. She had an open and intelligent countenance, her dark face lit up with joy, and such eyes, words cannot picture them. I looked upon this poor, innocent, beautiful little savage with admiration and pity. Captain Waddell paid a final courtesy visit, informing the chief that he would convey to the Confederate president the kindness shown Shenandoah and the respect paid the flag. The captain presented the chief a silk scarf, which he admired, and received in turn an artfully woven belt of coconut fibers and wool. The chief bestowed two dead chickens wrapped in coconut leaves and a dozen coconuts as gifts for President Davis. The host responded, Tell Jeff Davis he is my brother and a great warrior, and that I am very poor, and that our tribes are friends, and if he will send your vessel for me, I will go see him in his country. Waddell preserved the coconut belt as a memento from, quote, the only sovereign who had an independence of character and fearlessness of disposition to perform a common duty toward a righteous people and a just cause. It could be noted that the Confederacy had finally, 3 days after Appomattox, achieved its primary foreign policy objective, recognition from and offer of assistance by a foreign power. With morale restored by rest, recreation, and destruction, Shenandoah sailed once more, leaving an enduring legacy in this faraway place. 120 sailors left behind from the destroyed whalers, Hawaiians, other Pacific Islanders, and a few New Englanders were caught up in island politics and war. The descendants are there today. While the war struggled to conclusion and the nation began to bind its wounds, Shenandoah invaded the north, the deep cold of the Bering Sea. She fired the last gun of the Civil War, 10 weeks after Appomattox, and set the land of the midnight sun aglow with flaming Yankee whalers. Shenandoah captured 24 vessels in 1 week, an unprecedented accomplishment that a few months before would have been greeted with jubilation in the south and despair in the north. In the preceding 4 years, 8 rebel commerce raiders had destroyed over 100,000 tons of Union shipping worth $17 million. But the major impact had been psychological, the real damage done by fear of capture. Marine insurance rates soared. Only 1 in 100 Yankee vessels actually was taken, but another 800,000 tons, about 1,000 ships, were sold into foreign ownership to sail under the protection of a neutral flag, primarily Great Britain's. This was called the flight from the flag. It was a blow from which the United States Merchant Service never recovered. Despite these losses, however, rebel cruisers put not a dent in the industrial war machine of the United States or in the burgeoning trade that supported it. Commerce just shifted to neutral ships, and whaling was ebbing anyway, while the blockade progressively throttled the South. Most Confederate raiders were penned in neutral ports, confiscated before they could get underway, or decommissioned after unproductive cruises. Fending off howls of protest from Northern ship owners and shippers, Union Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles diverted only a few warships from the blockade to hunt Confederate cruisers. The USS Kearsarge sank Alabama only after she completed the most destructive cruise of the war and was too tired to continue. The USS Wachusett took the unsuspecting and unprepared Florida in Bahia Harbor only by an egregious violation of Brazilian neutrality. Shenandoah encircled the globe without being caught at all. But this was also deliberate economic and psychological warfare, not unlike the strategy of William Tecumseh Sherman torching his way through Georgia and the Carolinas. In the fall of 1864, when Shenandoah began her cruise, Northerners were pessimistic about victory. Union desertion surged, and the government was deep in debt. Bloodbaths at the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, and Cold Harbor, and stalemate in the trenches around Petersburg brought a chorus of condemnation down on President Lincoln and General Grant. Pressure to negotiate peace was intense. The president despaired of winning re-election in November. What if Shenandoah had cruised a year earlier, achieving the same results, on top of the destruction already wrought by her sisters? How would news of another Alabama loose in the Pacific during the summer doldrums of 1864 have contributed to Northern malaise and to Lincoln's reelection prospects? The Confederacy might have been as close to independence that summer as at any time during the war. This was not an irrational strategy. By the spring of 1865, when Shenandoah reached the Bering Strait, however, there could be no such hope. After destroying a good portion of the whaling fleet and scattering the rest, Shenandoah headed south. Off the coast of California, a passing British vessel delivered news of the end of the war. Former Confederates became pariahs, men without a country, a profession, fortune, or future, presumably subject to imprisonment or hanging as pirates. Their fears amplified by great distance, these Southerners could only imagine homes destroyed, families destitute and starving, menfolk imprisoned, dead, or executed. On 6 November 1865, Shenandoah limped into Liverpool. Captain Waddell lowered the last Confederate banner without defeat or surrender and abandoned his tired vessel to the British. He and his officers went ashore to reconstitute their lives. "I claim for her officers and men a triumph over their enemies and over every obstacle. And for myself, I claim having done my duty," wrote Captain Waddell. The Shenandoah combined the epitome of an ancient maritime heritage with the most advanced technology of the time. She represented a new concept in an old strategy of naval warfare and was a good example of what a weaker naval power can accomplish in what we today call asymmetric warfare. The men of Shenandoah heeded the call of their leaders, putting their lives, fortune, and honor on the line. They sought to serve in the best traditions of the United States Navy, from which several came, and which they took as their model. Judging by their accomplishments, they succeeded. The Confederate Navy was a paradigm of innovation, creative strategy, and professionalism under nearly unmanageable circumstances. The Shenandoah and her men deserve to be remembered. Along with their Union counterparts, they have much to teach us. This is, as Admiral Sims describes, a biography of a cruise and a microcosm of the Confederate American experience. Thank you.
Let us know if you have some questions. One of the perks that I get is I get to toss out the first couple, but raise your hand. Charlie, mm-hmm. talk a little bit about my favorite guy at the Battle of Bladensburg, Joshua Barney, how he got there, and how did he and his flotilla men fare in that battle?
Well, Barney almost missed the battle, as you may have heard or know. He was, after his flotilla was destroyed in Upper Marlboro, he brought his men back to the Navy Yard, where he was assigned to guard the Navy Yard Bridge, which goes over the lower Anacostia River, then known as the Eastern Branch of the Potomac. He's guarding this bridge and really not doing much of anything, and the British had decided at this point to attack and do an end around on the lower bridges by literally crossing the Anacostia where it could be forded, which is at Bladensburg, Maryland. There's a reason why they're at Bladensburg, is that there was no other place really was easy to cross. And you could burn the bridge over the East Capitol Street, then known as Stoddard's Bridge, where you could burn the Navy Yard Bridge, and they're never going to get across. They don't have the bridging equipment or the time. So it was almost obvious they were going to go up there. But nonetheless, Barney's men are guarding the bridge and stuck there when William Winder rides off to the battle just about an hour north by horseback, but very close to where the Navy Yard is at Bladensburg. And as a result, what happens is, to cut to the chase very quickly here, James Madison is riding by. He's this very kind of tiny guy in a black frock coat. He's about 5'4", and he's got these two massive horse pistols strapped to his waist. Some people said he looked like a kid playing at war. And Barney runs up to him and says, "Look, the action's to the north of here. Why don't you allow us to come and be at the battle?" And President says, "Sure," and he allows him to do that. And basically, Barney then gathers up his flotilla men and sailors, as well as the Marine Company from Marine Barracks 8th and I Streets, Washington, D.C., still there to this day, oldest post in the Corps. Had to get that plug in. And it survives, by the way, the burning of Washington, which is another story. But they go then into the battle. But that's one reason why they're in the third line, is that they literally get to the battle 1 hour before the British arrive at the battlefield. So that's how they ended up there.
Wow, but how did they do in the battle?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that part. Yeah, they were probably the only troops that turned in a credible performance in the battle. The militia ran. The Army was ordered by Winder to leave the field without firing a shot. The Navy and Marines were stuck and guarding the road into Capitol Hill. It is estimated that maybe they stayed there because Winder didn't believe it was within his purview as a commanding officer of Army troops to give orders to the Navy. So therefore, Barney received none. And as a result, Barney literally is left alone to guard the road on his own. They do fairly well. The only repulse of British troops on the battlefield that day is going to be inflicted by the U.S. Marines and Navy flotilla men at the battle near Turnacliffe's Bridge. So,
wow. Dwight, I was taking notes as you were talking, and I found particularly interesting some of the crew. And you mentioned African Americans.
Yes.
And you mentioned men who were descended from people who had fought with George Washington. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Well, concerning the crewmen, one of Captain Waddell's most vexing concerns was getting a full crew. He needed over about 120 men to fully man the ship and the guns. And he tried to recruit from when he bought the ship. He tried to recruit from his original crew and from the crew that was from the supply ship that brought their guns to them. And he didn't get nearly as many as he wanted. So he also recruited from captured vessels, and he recruited in Melbourne illegally, by the way. But he would take anybody who would come on board, and he had some gold. He would pay them two or three times what a merchant sailor made, and he offered them prize money at the end of the war, which, of course, they never got. But he recruited at least three and maybe a couple more African Americans, and one of them, at least one of them, he paid as an ordinary seaman. And he also recruited many other nationalities. And this was a long-standing tradition in the United States Navy, actually ever since the Revolution. It was much more integrated, much more cosmopolitan, much more diverse, and of necessity, because a sailor is a sailor is a sailor, and it doesn't matter where he comes from if he has the skills. So there was no There was no issue of slavery on board ship.
Although, right, if the person could do the job, he can do the job.
He can do the job, right. Yeah. And although being a sailor in those days wasn't that far different from being a slave anyway because of the of the labor involved and the authoritarian structure. But the authoritarian structure of shipboard life, of course, had evolved over centuries in the British Navy and picked up by the United States Navy. I was struck in the officers, who were, of course, all Americans, I was struck by their the widespread of representation. Sidney Smith Lee, Jr. was one of the senior lieutenants, and he was a nephew of Robert E. Lee, a brother of Fitzhugh Lee, and... Mason was a grandson of founder George Mason, and there were other connections there that that were just fascinating. One fellow was really an anomaly. He was a middle-class Missourian. He actually had been a drugstore clerk and got enamored of the ocean from the Midwest. And since I'm from Iowa, I could relate to that. And but he managed to get an appointment to the Naval Academy. He didn't report because the war started, so he then reported to the Confederate Navy and worked his way up. But being from the Midwest, and he didn't quite relate to the sort of aristocratic milieu of his Southern and deep Southern compatriots.
Interesting. Interesting. Do we have some questions? Okay, Charlie, what was the fate? What happened to the Colonial Marines you mentioned? And you can tell I'm interested in African-American history.
Yes, the Colonial Marines, they only were able to recruit about 300 to 400 of them, and they did serve with distinction in the 1814 campaign in particular. But Cochrane allowed them to then be transported to the island in the British Caribbean of their choice. Or they could go to Bermuda or Canada. Many of them ended up in Nova Scotia, Canada, after the war with their families. But it's important to note that Cochrane made it clear that when you escaped to his lines, if you were a slave, you were not required to serve in the Colonial Marines if you were an African-American male. You could literally opt out and say, I'd like to be taken to Trinidad or I'd like to go to Jamaica, and he would take them there. These are the folks, the Colonial Marines, that volunteered to stay. They were paid a wage of a Royal Marine, the same wage that the Royal Marines would receive. They got the red coat, they got some training, and they were used on raids and skirmishes against the Americans.
They actually saw combat?
They did, especially on the eastern shore of Virginia.
Wow.
So they would make landings. Oftentimes, they would make these long raids up these tributaries. The slaves would go back into their former neighborhoods and knew exactly how to get back.
Wow. Any questions? Yeah, we've got a question now.
The crews of the whalers that were sunk?
Yes.
Were they civilians, and what happened to them?
The crews, yes. These were entirely either merchant trading vessels or whalers that were captured by the Shenandoah and the other Confederate commerce raiders. And to a man, they were just removed from their ships, and then they would take one, the slowest and the oldest of the captured vessels, and put it under what they call bond, which is an agreement signed by the captain in the name of the owners that at the end of the war, the owners would pay the Confederacy the value of ship and cargo. And this was a legitimate item of international debt, assuming the Confederacy had gained independence, which, of course, it didn't. But there were no casualties during the entire cruise of the Shenandoah, except two of the Shenandoah sailors died late in the cruise from natural causes. But they removed the sailors and their effects. They were not allowed to touch their personal effects, although a few things managed to slip away. But they were all either put ashore in Melbourne or put on ships and sent on their way.
Wait for the microphone. The microphone's coming around to you.
I understand that at or after Bladensburg, that James Monroe had an important role, took over from the Armstrong or from the Secretary of War, and yeah. I was sort of unclear as to exactly what his role was.
Well, that's a great question. James Monroe was present on the battlefield at Bladensburg and played a pretty significant role in fouling up the battle for General Winder.
Without, that's why I was laughing.
Yeah, without consulting General Winder on the battlefield, Monroe maneuvered whole units of Maryland militia, placing them 500 yards behind where Winder thought they were supposed to be. And he did this based on the fact that he had been an Army officer during the American Revolution, and he believed that he was as capable of general as anybody else on that battlefield. But as a result of the debacle of Bladensburg, a lot of the ire of the American public rested upon the Secretary of War, John Armstrong. And John Armstrong was a rather, he had a rather unfortunate habit of saying what he thought at the time, and he wrote a very condemnatory letter against the President of the United States for the problems they had at Bladensburg, and rather than take the hit himself, he blamed Madison. Very quickly, Madison and Monroe got together and decided that Armstrong had to go. And within 2 weeks of Bladensburg, Armstrong is moving out the door and going to have to return to New York, his home state, never to be seen in American public office again. But Monroe then assumes the job of both Secretary of State, which his job was at the time. He then takes over as Secretary of War. So he's holding both departments down simultaneously following Bladensburg.
The only time that's happened in American history, right?
Not that I know of. I know Henry Kissinger at one time was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State at the same time, but that's not two departments.
Dwight, describe the ship for us. How long was it? How fast could it move? How was it armed?
Well, the ship is fascinating, too, because it was a clipper ship, and it was the British Tea Clipper, which many consider, and I tend to agree, the epitome of the clipper ship era. And it was a beautiful ship, but it was also had a steam engine, and it's what they call an auxiliary steamer. The steam engine was intended to help it through contrary winds on its cruises when it was going to China to pick up cargoes of tea. There were only a few clipper ships built with steam engines because they were not commercially successful. It turned out that the advantage gained from having a steam engine did not compensate for the loss of cargo space and the extra expense of cargo or coal and engineering crewmen. But it was a perfect combination as a commerce raider. The Alabama, by contrast, was built from the keel up as a commerce raider, and so it was ideally suited. The Shenandoah was very close to the Alabama in terms of its capabilities. It had the Shenandoah had six main guns, two 9-inch rifled cannon, and four 30-pound, 60-pound, I forget, smooth bores. It actually was as well armed, or close to as well armed, as any of the opponents it might have confronted. But they really didn't want to do that because the crew were not men of war's men, and they were not well trained at the guns, and they were not interested really in fighting a ship of war. If there was one Yankee ship, the Iroquois came closest to catching her, chased her around the Cape of Good Hope, or Cape of Good Hope was a couple weeks behind. If they had met up, it could have been a similar engagement to the Alabama and the Kearsarge, but Captain Waddell had no real interest in doing that if he could avoid it.
I see. So the weaponry was just to scare the merchants.
Yes. The weaponry was to bring to the merchant vessels under international law. If a warship, a commissioned warship, under international law of a recognized belligerent, our Confederacy was not a recognized nation, but she was a recognized belligerent in international law. The British had to do this in order to protect the neutrality of their ships. And that was a big controversy between the two nations. As a matter of fact, the whole issue almost brought on war between Great Britain and the United States. A commissioned warship could fire a cannon when approaching another ship of any nation. Under international law, the ship had to stop and be inspected. Now, when approaching a prospective target, the Commerce Raider could fly a false flag, and the Shenandoah did. She usually put up the British flag, sometimes the United States flag. But once they came close to the merchant vessel raised its flag in recognition. Then they fired a cannon. They shot across the bow, and they had to put up their real flag. Otherwise, they would be subject to prosecution as pirates. Once they did that, then they could inspect the ship. If the ship was an enemy ship or a ship carrying contraband, articles of war, then they were subject to confiscation. Now they would prefer to put a prize crew on board and send her back to a neutral port for sale, but that was an option wasn't open to them, so they had to destroy them. But they took off the crews, as they said.
Wow. Any other questions, Dwight? Charlie, aside from the obvious, Fort McHenry, the British take Washington fairly easily. British are stopped at Baltimore. Aside from Fort McHenry, what made the big difference at Baltimore?
The biggest difference was Samuel Smith. Samuel Smith was not William Winder. And Samuel Smith was an iron-willed major general of the Maryland militia. He had the confidence of the sitting governor, Levin Winder, who happened to be the uncle of William Winder, the guy that lost the Battle of Bladensburg. And his uncle recognized that Baltimore is the prize in Maryland, and if they lose that, they lose a lot. And as a result, Smith requires, within taking over the job, he requires the entire town to fall out. Men, women, children, black, white, young, old, they all have to fall out and dig emplacements, entrenchments, rifle pits, cannon positions up and down the side of Hampstead Hill that guards the eastern side of the town. They had several out-of-towners come in. One guy named George Douglas, who was from Pennsylvania, and he rides into town. He says, you would not believe how Smith has converted the town into a veritable Gibraltar. And he really gets himself, a gold star in my mind. He also recognizes that the real vulnerability of Fort McHenry is the ferry branch, which is the other side of the harbor. And he builds two forts behind Fort McHenry, one called Battery Babcock and the other one called Fort Covington. And the British actually try on the night of September the 13th to get around Fort McHenry by rowing longboats full of Royal Marines that would land behind the fort and take it by storm from the rear. Smith anticipated that. And as a result, militia captain said the British fired up a blue rocket light, which gave away their position, allowing Battery Babcock and Covington to engage their longboats, driving them off with heavy casualties. He said, we saw no more blue rocket lights that evening. So, worked out well. Smith.
One more question. There we go. Mark?
For Charles, at Bladensburg... At Bladensburg, if there had been better American leadership, could the battle have been won, or were the troops just so inexperienced it was lost before it was fought?
Well, it's interesting. I looked up what the British thought, and Robert Ross was absolutely astounded that the Americans allowed the British Army to travel from Benedict, Maryland, which is on the Patuxent River, all the way across Prince George's County, about 20 to 25 miles, and not get harassed by anyone, not even a patrol. Winder was the inexperienced general officer, is betting the entire security and the entire outcome of whether or not Washington, D.C. survives on the roll of the dice of a single engagement. And Ross was saying, well, when are they going to start to attack us? Why are they allowing us to get up close to the... And literally, the battle is fought virtually on the District of Columbia border. And when they lose, there is nothing between them and Washington, D.C. itself. But you're right about, they were, could the Americans have won? These are four veteran British regiments, Wellington's veterans. I do not believe the Maryland militia and the Virginia militia that were there could have stood up, even if they were better handled. However, what they could have done was they could have engaged the British in a war of attrition and in a campaign of attrition beginning at Benedict, Maryland, ambushing them like the American militia did at Lexington and Concord in 1775, so that the British would be concerned to get too far away from their base of operations. One thing that Ross pointed out a number of times was he didn't feel comfortable going all the way up to Washington, D.C., and he kept reminding everybody that, you know, we don't have cavalry, we don't have a lot of artillery, we're in enemy country, this could be bad for us if we get ourselves caught here. And Coburn said, not to worry, I fought these guys last year and they won't stand. There was some thought to giving to making a fortification out of the Capitol. There was just the two wings of the Capitol today. There was a awning in between made out of wood. So the modern dome part hadn't been built yet. And it was suggested to Winder and to Madison that maybe we'll just turn this into a fort and we'll defend Capitol Hill. Basically, Winder and Madison came to the conclusion that all was lost. They all retreat to Montgomery County Courthouse, which is modern-day Rockville, regroup, and try to fight another day. That other day is going to come just 2 weeks later at Baltimore. But a different set of commanders there. A great question. I don't believe the Americans would have done much better.
Dwight, what happened to the Shenandoah afterwards?
Well, the British turned the Shenandoah over to the American authorities in Liverpool. And they tried to sail it back to the United States, but ran into some storms, had a problem with the engines, and didn't make it, turned back. So by that time, they were pretty sick of the whole thing. So they put the Shenandoah up for sale, and she was bought by the Sultan of Zanzibar as a yacht. So she operated out of Zanzibar for a number of years as the Sultan's yacht until 1875 or 6, I believe, and then she was damaged in a typhoon and eventually sank and is now rests on the bottom of the Indian Ocean.
Wow, and there was you alluded to this earlier, there was a lawsuit brought against the British by the United States, correct?
Yes. Yes, the United States sued Great Britain at the end of the war in a large affair that came to be known as the Alabama Claims. And the United States sued Great Britain for its support of Confederate commerce raiders during the entire war. It maintained that that they violated neutrality by building and supplying and manning ships that they then sold to the Confederacy. The British, of course, didn't agree with that. Under international law, ships were legitimate articles of commerce and trade. The British didn't actually arm the ships in British territory. The Confederates are very smart about this. They managed to acquire the ships so under the radar and sailed them outside British territory and then armed them from supply ships. The British were interested after the war in recovering better relations with the United States and putting the whole thing behind them. And so they allowed it to go to an international tribunal in Geneva, and they eventually found in favor of the United States to the tune of $15.5 million. But that was only for the Alabama, what the Alabama did, and also what the Shenandoah, the ships that the Shenandoah took after Melbourne. The British would not admit to any complicity for the ships Shenandoah took before her visit to Melbourne, because when the Shenandoah left Great Britain, she was a registered British merchantman, and she was sold and commissioned in Madeira, which was outside British territory, so they weren't liable for that. But since they did resupply her and repair her in Melbourne, they admitted liability for ships sunk after that.
Wow. Well, I want to remind everybody that these gentlemen will be selling these wonderful books immediately following. Let's give them a round of applause, everybody. Thanks for coming. Hope you enjoyed it.